Welcome to Glossophilia's podcast series. We're back. I'm Louise.
And I'm Paul.
And today we're going to be talking about a difficult but important and pretty relevant subject, and that's the language of death and dying.
Yeah, and I was reminded of a nice quote by Haruki Murakami, that death is not the opposite of life, but part of it, and part of everybody's, actually. But now that we have reached the numbers that we have, and the tragic numbers of people who have died of this coronavirus, in the U.S., 470,000 as of this recording, and in the U.K., 115,000, and now almost 2.5 million worldwide. Mm. I mean, staggering numbers.
And we talk about death, died, dying. These are obviously words that we all understand. They're pretty unequivocal and unambiguous, and they're relevant to all of us. But the interesting thing is that it's a subject that most of us actually find really hard to discuss. It's almost a universal thing that we find it hard to utter those words, dead, death, dying. So much so that we even struggle to find a way to start this podcast and to start this episode, how to broach the subject of death, and even what to name this episode, because it's such a sort of sensitive and difficult issue.
But I thought your idea was really a good one, Louise, which is just to confront it head on.
Right.
You know, like, because all of the language of death and dying is usually avoiding the main subject.
Right. Exactly. Which, yeah. Yes, exactly. I mean, it's interesting that it's probably the most talked about topic in the world today. And yet it's something that we all still feel slightly awkward and, you know, it's sort of an inappropriate thing to have a discussion about.
And something else I'd like to mention is that the fact that we're talking about this is meant to be nothing but respectful. Really.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
there are points in this discussion, maybe later, where we're going to sound a bit light about it, but it's something we both take very seriously and both have experienced maybe more than our fair share of.
Yes. Or unfair share of.
Even more.
Yeah.
And I think by nature, and maybe we've always been historically reluctant to deal with the subject of death, especially in any straightforward terms. I don't know whether it's superstition or fear or possibly respect even.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really like the last taboo or one of the last taboos in our language, isn't it? Yeah.
And actually, maybe for most people, it's a combination of all of those things that creates the discomfort.
Yes. But
have you noticed, I mean, just as we're talking here, everybody almost always tries to soften the effect of what they're trying to say.
Right.
And in doing so, we end up tying ourselves up in knots, linguistically especially.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we'd want to talk about today.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is to do with the sort of enduring taboo that's associated with death. I mean, there are, you know, historical taboos around the world that in some cultures, they actually ban the utterance of a dead person's name.
Hmm. For fear of what, exactly?
Well, Freud argued, actually, that these taboos were... it was a fear that the utterance of that name might bring a return of that person's ghost.
Hmm. I haven't heard that one.
Yeah. I think we find it hard to refer to a recent death in a very direct way.
And anybody who's ever struggled to write a condolence card would
right,
know what that feels
exactly.
like.
Exactly, yes, yeah. So we're sort of struggling in an emotional way, and that comes out, translates into a sort of verbal struggle to find the right words to talk about death.
That many of us deal with the language of death and the difficulties of the language of death is the use of euphemisms. And the word euphemism dates back to the 1650s, originating from a Greek word euphemismos, which basically means trying to find a favorable word rather than an unfortunate one. Mm-hmm. And this superstitious avoidance, as we talked about before, of using words of ill omen, let's say. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there are out there a lot of euphemisms mm-hmm. for the word to die.
Yes, it's almost made for the word to die.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, all in the past tense, and mm-hmm. they fall into a couple of different categories as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah, I would say the most common one I hear, and increasingly, I think, is the word pass. Mm-hmm. He's passed away, he's passed over, she's passed on. But actually, probably most commonly, it's simply passed.
Yeah, that she's seems to be passed. The current favorite, I would say. It's what I hear most often.
Which
I think, I mean, it gets right to our point, because if you think about it, it's a really soft word for mm-hmm. the activity that's taking place. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, mm-hmm. It's literally passive in its sound.
And it's, I think you might have said before, it's sort of vague. It's mm-hmm. it's suitably vague. That it doesn't really... I mean, I think one thing it does convey is the idea of moving somewhere, going from right. one, passing from one place or plane to another.
Which has, if you think about it, a lot of religious assumptions associated. You're assuming there is something to pass to.
Exactly, Yeah.
And so much of the language seems to come from that, would you say? I mean, the expressions that we use, he's gone to meet his maker.
Right, right.
He's been taken from us.
Right.
He's shuffled off. Which implies that somebody else did the taking.
Yes. But then that also has a religious connotation, doesn't it?
Exactly. And one in that same category, I would say, one that I have always found troubling is that... she is in a better place.
Right. Which is presumptuous,
tremendously,
essentially.
I think so, too.
Maybe that's unfair to say that if it's a religious person, but yes, it does.
But it's hard to hear if you're not.
Exactly.
Which was the case for me. And there are two some very specific words, which I've also found curious, like the word perished.
Mm.
Have you ever noticed that it's only used for really specific deaths, in a way, or specific ways of dying?
Yes, it's usually an accident or a fire or something rather dramatic.
I think that's built into the definition.
Yes,
the Oxford... So it's a weird. It's not a euphemism exactly.
It's a more specific. I mean, the Oxford English Dictionary actually gives the definition to suffer a violent, sudden, or untimely death.
Hmm. I guess applies to everyone related to the coronavirus, I would say.
Yes, yes, interestingly. And I associate that word in my mind with journalism, I guess because those sorts of deaths are reported.
Right, and it's true, you wouldn't hear that spoken. That's
not
something
necessarily.
You would read.
Yeah. And actually, talking of journalism, the Associated Press Style Guide tells us to use the words death and die. It actually says don't use euphemisms like passed on or pass away, except in a direct quote.
Interesting.
So that's what the Associated Press Style advises us to do.
And something else that came up in the research on this topic, a phrase or a term that you had discovered that I had never heard of, dysphemism.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is that?
Well, it's a bit like a euphemism, but whereas a euphemism is trying to find a favorable, gentler word instead of a difficult one, a dysphemism is actually substituting a vulgar or derogatory word.
Mm-hmm. Like,
for one good example is croaked. People think that might come from the sound of a death rattle, actually, the word croak.
But now that you mentioned that topic, there is an expression that I've heard many years ago that I don't know if it's still in use, but called to buy the farm.
Right.
He bought the farm.
Which I
have you ever heard that one?
No, I haven't. Yeah. I haven't heard that
so
one.
So, from what I understand, it's an American term that comes from World War II, where a pilot who had been downed would receive, or his family would receive, an insurance payment that would actually allow them to buy the farm that they might have been currently tenants of.
Hmm. So
or
interesting.
Pay off their mortgage,
yeah.
So to speak. So, yeah.
Very interesting. And actually, there's another expression, dysphemism, that comes from the war, and that's pushing up daisies.
Oh, yeah.
You know that
I've
one?
I've heard that, but...
I don't know why the word daisies is there, but that apparently it was commonly used during the First World War by soldiers.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was slang from 1917 or so. It actually, I think, dated back earlier than that to the mid-19th century, but it is a war slang for
it's curious. With the daisies involved, I would never have guessed that was a military expression.
Yeah.
But yeah, and when you start to make the list of dysphemisms, I mean, kicked the bucket,
right.
for instance, which, you know, sounds almost funny.
Yes, or cashed in his chips.
The one that you'd used, one I'd never heard before. Go ahead.
Yeah,
go
well, ahead. Popped his clogs. Is that the one you're thinking of? Yes.
I can't even imagine where that comes from.
I have no idea. I mean, I imagine it must be a British expression. In fact, I think it's interesting that you'd probably hear most of these more often in England than here in the States.
And why do you think that is?
That's a good question, actually. I'm sure that the Brits use dysphemisms more than euphemisms for death.
Hmm.
And I wonder, I actually wonder if it's to do with our humour, the British humour,
mm-hmm.
which is often sort of rooted in slightly dismissive or derogatory languages.
And darker and drier.
Darker, drier,
by
yes.
nature, yeah.
Ironic. Hmm. It's sort of, I guess, rooted in irony a bit.
Yeah, and if you think of it, it's not that far from euphemism in the sense that it's the discomfort with the discussion, and that's just another way of dealing with it.
Right.
Is to make fun of it. Or
yes, yes. And I think that is a way that Brits deal with discomfort, actually, mm-hmm. with humour.
Yeah.
So that might explain it. Another reason might be to do with religion.
Right, which, if you think of it, I mean, America is a much more religiously based society
yes.
in general.
Yes.
Maybe that's why they're using euphemisms more than dysphemisms.
Dysphemisms. Hmm. Perhaps political correctness is another
true, which is
factor here. Whether you could argue that the Americans are more politically correct than the Brits. it's a
they
sort
try.
Of circular argument, really, isn't it? But I think that might have something to do with it.
But the other thing that strikes me as odd is that these dysphemisms that we've been talking about are blunter, I mean, a little harder on the ear, and you would have thought that the Americans would be the blunt ones.
Mm.
But I think you're right. I think it's about the humor as a way of
yes.
guarding yourself. Or
yes, I mean, in some ways, the most blunt way of describing what we're discussing is to use the word die.
Hmm.
He died. That's probably the bluntest way rather than he
right.
croaked.
And the one we're all avoiding.
Yes, exactly. So far we've talked mainly about how we, the general public, talk about death and dying in our
mm-hmm.
sort of everyday speech and language and condolence.
Right. But good point. There's also an important way that we publicly speak about death, and that is the obituary,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. the published announcement of a death. It's a form that dates back to early Rome, and the reading of which is still a daily routine for some,
mm-hmm.
including me.
Mm-hmm.
Also one that I've heard jokingly referred to as the Irish sports page. You could imagine why that is.
Yeah.
So the purpose and the origin of the obituary is basically to report on the loss of a member of your community,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's funny nowadays, you know, that you used to have to, like I say, read it in the newspaper. But now that we've got the internet, and most people are getting their news from the internet, this idea of community can now be really pretty widely expanded. Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, to be honest, that's where I'm reading obituaries. I no longer get the physical paper. And what's curious is that now that it's no longer printed or necessarily printed, they can be longer and they can be more diverse. Mm-hmm. And who they write about can be more diverse because if you've got limited column space, well, it's going to be, you know, the famous sports figure or the celebrity or the famous writer or whomever. But now that, it, you know, it's on the net, you can have quite a wide range of people. And people who were maybe never reported on before because they weren't that notable. Mm-hmm. And it's really curious. I've noticed there's a column now, a special column within the obituaries in the New York Times, for instance, called Those We've Lost, mm-hmm. which are specifically for COVID-19 deaths that right. they're related. And it's a really interesting read because it could be a hospital worker, it could mm-hmm. be, you know, a school teacher, it's no, or, you know, a brilliant scientist. Mm-hmm. And the range is really pretty impressive.
I think I've heard that on the British,
Brits are doing a variation?
Yeah, I think I've heard the same.
No, it's a really interesting idea. And you also hear the paper asking people to send in stories. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not just journalists writing about important folks. It's lots of people contributing these ideas and allowing them, people, to memorialize themselves, their loved ones, and mm-hmm. the accounts of the lives of their loved ones.
It's quite a skill writing an obituary.
It
well,
is.
Isn't it?
I've done it a couple of times. It's not easy. Just to summarize a life, basically. Which is basically what all obituaries end up being, is the story of a life. Which is why I find it sort of fascinating reading. It's like a mini biography. And you hear about all sorts of people you never would have otherwise known about. So, I mean, friends have said, that's a really grim way to begin your day. But actually, I find it really enlightening in many ways. I have to say, The Times has been doing a good job. There are other places. I also like The Economist. They have mm-hmm. one page each week that they dedicate to the life of somebody, which is very well written and mm-hmm. very well researched. And there's a program, I don't mean to sound too morose about this, but there's also a program on BBC that I enjoy called The Last Word. It's a radio show.
My father was on that when he died.
He was featured on that program.
Yes, he was featured on that. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Were you interviewed as part of it?
No, I wasn't.
Because they usually interview experts on the lives of.
No, I wasn't for that one, but I did talk to people at The Guardian and The Times for obituaries. So his obituary there. Yeah.
And did you and your family write your father's obituary? I mean, obviously, in those papers, they had professionals doing it.
Yes, and we talked to them. So not in that case, no. We didn't write. Yeah.
No, as you were saying earlier, it's a tough job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you've done it yourself, you appreciate seeing when it's well done.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
So I think that's actually where my interest stemmed from.
Yeah. Talking about the obituaries, and there's another similar form of language about somebody recently deceased, and that's the eulogy. Now, unlike the obituary, which is often, I mean, not always, as you say, but it's often written by somebody who doesn't know the person who's died, the eulogy is usually read or said by a family member or a friend or somebody who's being
and
close to them.
If I understand, the eulogies are usually delivered, right? I mean, they're
usually
spoken, performed.
Yes, at a funeral or some sort of memorial service. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about the eulogy, as well as being partly biographical, like the obituary, they're more really getting at the good, valuable qualities of the person who's just died. In fact, the word eulogy actually is from the 15th century, and it's from a Greek word, eulogia. I'm not sure how you pronounce that, but it actually means praise, good, fine language, and that's what the eulogy is. But we shouldn't confuse the word eulogy with the word elegy, actually, mm-hmm. which I have often confused in my mind in the past. An elegy, unlike the eulogy which is spoken, an elegy tends to be written. It's a poem or a written...
Do you know the Rilke, the Dwino elegies?
I don't.
No, worth a read. But there's also, I was just noticing the other day, there's a series of paintings, which I absolutely love, by Cy Twombly that are based on those Rilke poems. Whether you'd call them elegies or not,
but they're
inspired by the elegies.
Yes. A
beautiful series of paintings, if you ever get a chance.
Yeah, interesting. So I guess they come in, as well as coming in different formats, they also, I guess they can range from the sentimental, they can be lighthearted, they can be funny, so they're quite, I've heard hilarious eulogies.
Really?
Eulogies, sorry. Yeah. And yet, often they're very poignant and serious.
Again, and must be difficult to write or mm-hmm. perform.
Yes. So there's another area of language about death that we could talk about. It's another E word, and that's the epitaph, which is basically the few words that are on a person's gravestone. And they're meant to capture the meaning or the essence of that person's life. It's pretty hard to come up with concise language to just capture somebody's life in a few short words. Even for the best writers and editors amongst us, that's a pretty tall task. And, of course, it's especially hard for, the spouses and families who've just lost a dear relative to then have to...
I can only imagine.
To address this task. In fact, when my father died a few years ago, I remember quite vividly how difficult it was for us to come up with an epitaph.
And you and your family did this together?
We did it together. So that was hard. And it was especially hard because my father was quite a stickler for language. Mm-hmm.
That would explain a lot.
So, yes, it was difficult doing it by committee. And there was this feeling of, the pressure of wanting to get it right for him and for us. So, yes, it's a process that's quite fraught with different emotions and memories and...
Yeah, and the succinctness that you have to...
Exactly.
...get it down to.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. And I don't know, I guess most of the epitaphs that I could think of, or the famous ones anyway, were mostly written by the person themselves. I mean, you've heard of some of those.
Yes. In fact, Robert Frost was one of those who... he died when he was 88 years old, but he'd actually sort of written his own epitaph a couple of decades before that in a poem that he'd written called The Lesson for Today. And this is the bit from the poem. "And were an epitaph to be my story, I'd have a short one ready for my own. I would have written of me on my stone, I had a lover's quarrel with the world."
It's quite good.
Yes.
No, I remember hearing years ago the Dorothy Parker's epitaph, and at the time I didn't know if it was real. The New York satirist, I'm sure you're familiar with her work. So she, in her inimitable wit, decided that her epitaph should be "Excuse my dust." Because she was also known to be a pretty bad housekeeper. And I just always thought that was pretty funny. And to have a sense of humor at that point.
Yeah.
But it turns out it's actually true. And this is currently.
It is her.
Yeah.
It really is.
It is her currently official epitaph.
Interesting.
Above her resting place, too.
How very appropriate. paradoxical, actually, that even though we have this inability and this reluctance to talk openly and directly about death, or maybe it's because of that reluctance and that inability, it's amazing that death is the subject that perhaps other than love is the most written about, talked about in...
Sung about,
yes, in poetry and song and literature.
That's true. Very good point.
And I think there's so much of it that it would be impossible to even choose a few examples of it. I mean, it's everywhere. Right. It's all around us.
No, but actually, while we're on the topic, there are a number of really good books on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd say many. I think I've read all of the ones that we're going to discuss. But and again, these are not just about the language that we're talking about, but the larger issues related to death and dying. I don't know if you've ever read On Death and Dying, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
But I'm very familiar with it. I mean, I've...
The stages of denial and acceptance and so on. And one that came out a couple of years ago by a guy named Atul Gawande. I don't know if you know
Being him. Being Immortal. I'm actually halfway through it.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah. I found his things in The New Yorker many years ago, and I really enjoyed the way he writes. Another one that I would really recommend, dense and strange as it might be, is The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Sogyal Rinpoche.
I
use that pronunciation, maybe. It just has a lot of wisdom in it, ancient wisdom about how to deal with the process. And there were some things that were really useful to me that I got from that book. And also, on the funnier side, a British author who I like a lot, Julian Barnes.
Yes.
Nothing to be Afraid Of?
Yeah, I've been recommended that book, and I haven't actually read it, but I want to.
Yeah, because it's really worthwhile.
Yeah. Another book that I've been recommended by a number of friends is The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion.
Yeah, it's a beautiful piece.
Which I haven't read either, actually, because I guess I've been a bit reluctant to read it. I've been a bit nervous about reading it
It's touching on a subject too close. I mean, yes, it is the loss of her husband, which I know you've experienced.
Yeah.
It's a hauntingly beautiful read, though.
Really?
I would really recommend it.
Yeah.
They also did a stage play. I don't know if you've heard about this. Was it Vanessa Redgrave?
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
But it's a really good read. And
When Breath Becomes Air, I know is...
That's what I don't know.
And again, I haven't read it, but I've...
you've got it on your list.
I've got it on my list. That's by an American neurosurgeon, Paul Kalanithi.
Yeah, one I've heard of, but that's maybe the one of this group I haven't read. So, maybe we should post that on your blog, too, some of these names, so people
absolutely
can go back to find them.
Yes, exactly.
And picking up, Louise, with your point about how death is spoken about in every other language, poetry, song, and so on, stories, I think it's time for us to turn to our poetry section, something we've been doing in all of our podcasts. So I've got a poem called Afterwards by Thomas Hardy, which goes like this. When the present has latched its postern behind my tremulous stay, and the May month flaps its glad green leaves like wings, delicate filmed as new-spun silk, will the neighbor say, he was a man who used to notice such things? If it be in the dusk when an eyelid's soundless blink, the dewfall hawk comes crossing the shades to alight upon the wind-warped upland thorn, a gazer may think. To him, this must have been a familiar sight. If I pass during some nocturnal blackness, mothy and warm, when the hedgehog travels furtively over the lawn, one may say, he strove that such innocent creatures should come to no harm, but he could do little for them, and now he is gone. If, when hearing that I have been stilled at last, they stand at the door, watching the full starred heavens that winter sees, will this thought rise on those who will meet my face no more? He was one who had an eye for such mysteries. And will any say, when my bell of quittance is heard in the gloom, and a crossing breeze cuts a pause in its outrollings, till they rise again, as they were a new bell's boom? He hears it not now, but used to notice such things. Yeah, it's a mouthful, but...
It's very poignant,
yeah.
I think. And we had to have Thomas Hardy for a poem about death.
Of course. How fitting.
Yeah.
So, your turn.
I'm going to read a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay, who was a great American lyrical poet of the early 20th century. She actually used verse as a medium for her activism. She was a prominent feminist of her time, and she inspired a generation of women. In fact, she was the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1923. So I'm going to read her poem, Dirge Without Music, by Edna St. Vincent Millay. I am not resigned to the shutting away of loving hearts in the hard ground. So it is, and so it will be, for so it has been, time out of mind. Into the darkness they go, the wise and the lovely. Crowned with lilies and with laurel they go, but I am not resigned. Lovers and thinkers, into the earth with you. Be one with the dull, the indiscriminate dust. A fragment of what you felt, of what you knew. A formula, a phrase remains, but the best is lost. The answers quick and keen, the honest look, the laughter, the love, they are gone. They are gone to feed the roses. Elegant and curled is the blossom, fragrant is the blossom, I know, but I do not approve. More precious was the light in your eyes than all the roses in the world. Down, down, down into the darkness of the grave, gently they go, the beautiful, the tender, the kind. Quietly they go, the intelligent, the witty, the brave. I know, but I do not approve, and I am not resigned.
That's quite beautiful.
Mm.
So I think we're towards the end here. So I hope everybody listening to this will understand that we are trying not to treat this subject lightly. That we simply wanted to have a conversation about it, and mm-hmm. as we talked about from the top, just look at it head on, since we're all looking at it anyway.
Yes, and talking about it. And we want to send our condolences to the many, many people who've had to confront death.
Yeah, and not only recently, but historically.
Yes.
I mean, we've all been touched by it at some point.
Yeah.
So, good to be with you, Louise. Thanks
good
again.
Good to be with you, Paul. And thanks to our engineer, iTouch.
Yeah. Until next time, then.
Goodbye.
All our times have come. Here, but now they're done. See